John Johnson, better known as JJ, author of The Market Vibes by Alyosha Substack. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So, JJ, one of the things I want to start off by talking about is, let's say, the perception versus reality disconnect that we're seeing right now in the oil market. It's really an interesting time to try to wrap your head around many of the different demand and supply vectors, demand, supply, and inventory vectors within the oil market. But I want to get by, or I want to start by getting your take on current price right now. Is this, you know, possibly just an overcorrection, or do you think the market has it right for the current demand and supply outlook that we have?
Yes. Okay, so I'm just looking at the screen right now. We are almost exactly at the same price we were trading when this conflict with Iran, U.S. and Iran. There's two wars. One is Israel and Iran. That's obviously a separate war, although there's some common ground. And then, you know, we're in a war with Iran, as the United States, but it's not really a war. So since we're talking about oil, the first thing I'd like to say about this, whatever it is, I don't really have a good name for it, you know, it has a military dimension, but no one died. Or so far, we don't know really what the mortality rate was for the Iranians, but there were 15 Americans who died. Incidentally, not due to combat, about 20 Israelis, maybe 30. Very low mortality. Most of the Iron Dome was effective. And, you know, the worst case never really unfolded. So right now, we don't really need peace because there's no threat to oil anymore. The Omani Southern Corridor is working. I'm seeing Kepler Vertex, various other agency reporting. There's a ton of it on X. You know, 50 million a day has been coming out. So even if it was 20 million, or Trump said 19 million, or, you know, as the days roll by and the millions of oil, barrels of oil are coming out, pretty soon most of that oil, which was trapped behind the strait, is going to be out, which is going to change the negotiating dynamic dramatically. Deleveraging the IRGC and oil never really went up. I drove down from Canada last night, and I have Canadian family, so it took me about 8 hours. But in my head, as I was driving down, I was thinking, you know, I really haven't expressed this correctly. What happened, you know, between the 28th of February and the 9th of March, when we hit 120, about 700,000 contracts of futures were bought across the five major futures products on NYMEX and ICE, right? Maybe more, 740, 50,000, kind of hip shooting there, but it's huge. That translates into 750 million barrels. Mm-hmm. So there was never enough time for the conflict to really impact physical market, because a tremendous amount of oil was at sea, already bought, headed towards the destination to be delivered either in Asia or other parts of the world. So that took 2 or 3 weeks till the last ship actually came to port. Then there were significant number of barrels of sanctioned oil, somewhere around 150 million. They were just kind of floating around out there. Iran was sneaking out, you know, a couple million a day anyway during all this stuff. So oil was still coming out. Saudi had exit alternatives, you know, east-west pipelines and all that. We all know this crap. So what happened was, is we realized, you know, by May, after China cut their imports radically, it was like, what the fuck is that? You know, that the real bogey that was missing, this is low, and Reuters wrote a pretty straightforward journalistic piece on this in early June. The real bogey was like sub 6, maybe 5 million, maybe even fewer barrels that was really impacted by that. So rewind to the 750 million barrels of futures that were bought between the 20th of February and the 9th of March, right? And that's why the market shot up. I mean, if nobody bought those, nothing would have happened. Maybe it would have gone to 80 and rolled back down to the 70s. But of course, that's a massive amount of oil to take out. Well, so the COTs, commitment traders on managed money positions, have been down 13 weeks in a row. How long has the war been going? 15 weeks, right? So every week, that long position, because there was no responsiveness, you know, it never really went up. It just faded. And each cycle of delivery, at least on the NYMEX, I didn't really watch Brent that carefully because they don't have inventories over there, just ships. And they all lie. I won't go any further than that. But the EIA, our Department of Energy, you know, imposes heavy penalties on industry reporting. And if you don't report and report accurately, you can be audited, you can be fined. So that data is really like the gospel. You know, it's going to be as close to accurate as we're ever going to get. So, you know, I always watch WTI. So every week, about 50 million barrels was rolling off the futures position. So when they're selling 50 million of paper barrels, the markets become so fungible. Paper wet barrels, physical barrels in tanks, on ships, whatever, the ability to trade at light speed round the clock, you know, whether it's in New York or whether it's early Asia or it's in Dubai or London, you know, all of those markets, not only are they aware and active in an undulant way as their time zones roll into one another, so the breadth of liquidity is uniform, no matter when you really want to find a price. But the ability to swap, you know, or transact oil in motion, in pipes, on ships, in tanks, on the exchange, is facile. And a lot of people while the war was going on had an X, you know, they wanted oil to go up. I mean, ExxonMobil, Chevron, refiners today, the 3-2-1 crack size, I looked at it this morning, is like notional 3-2-1 is trading above 160. It's never been that high. It's never been that high. A $70 barrel of oil produces $160 of notional returns. Do you realize what that does for earnings? It's just like numbing, right? It's as good as Newmont's AISC at 1600 when gold was trading 5000. So these refiners of precious commodities, you know, sort of metals and oil, are making an insane amount of money. Yet their stocks are relatively unresponsive because we are in a very, I don't know how to describe it. We're in a transitional period of liquidity where, we'll get to bonds later, but hold this thought as I'm talking about it now. When you have a contraction in prices and a contraction of liquidity, that is disinflationary. And if it's severe, it's deflationary, right? Very simple way of looking at it. When you have expansion of liquidity and expansion of prices, whether via shortages, pandemics, or gushing liquidity coming out of the Fed balance sheet, prices go up. So you get stuff like silver going to 120 and gold going to 5,500 and so forth. But as we went into the war, the most important thing that no one was paying any attention to, I'm running around, hey, look at this. They're like, nah, you know, nobody listens to me anyway. I'm just a little guy with a handful of subscribers. But inventories were massive, were absolutely massive going in. Well, they were almost as big as they were going into COVID, right? Like billions, 8.2 billion barrels, according to the EIA. Some people say that's an understatement. So you put all these things together. What we really have is a great big nothing burger. We were adequately supplied. If we had, we shifted, you know, supplies from physical to paper. Well, Iran said, hey, nobody gets any more oil. Well, guess what? You know, there was plenty of oil around. The United States, on their own, were, I think our high export was like 6 million a day of black oil, and easily up as high as like 8 million a day of combined, you know, mole gas and distillates. And we're producing in total fluids 3 million a day more than we consume, importing 4 a day from Canada, Venezuela. We've got a lot of development in pipelines. We're selling leases in Alaska, liberating, you know, pretty much the whole Latin American sphere to be huge, you know, producers. And if you look at the big top-down picture, there's almost 1.7 trillion barrels. Just let's say that again, let that sink in. Anybody who's listening, hi. 1.7 trillion barrels of proven reserves of crude oil extant on the planet right now. We know where it is. You know, everybody knows where it is. So just the whole idea of a shortage is just very hard for me to, like, you know, accept. The industry is, the science is highly defined. Industry can find fun, bring to market very, very quickly. Oil, just all over the place. So, you know, in all that process, when you show some, and when you show a market that ought to be trading, I think it ought to be trading 70-ish, maybe a little lower right now, 60s. Because of what's happened, we could swoop down into the low 50s, but we're going to come back up to 70, in my opinion. So when you show them 100 or 120, actually, we had a few days when we were like 100, 109, 110 or something like that. Well, that, you know, that starts processes. You know, it creates development opportunities. You can uncap ducks. And of course, nobody's going to say, oh, wow, we're producing a whole lot of oil now if you're an oil producer. They're going to say exactly the opposite. I've quoted this before, but I'll say it again. On March 10th, that was the day after we traded 120. Nasser, the CEO of Aramco, said, I have to remember this carefully. He said, global reserves are at 5-year lows on an earnings call. And I didn't hear that. It wasn't on a call, but I read it a couple of days later. And of course, I know that's not true. I know the EIA just said global reserves were 8.2 billion. So, you know, okay. The CEO of Chevron sank tank bottom 6 or 8 weeks ago. And I was like, what the hell are you doing, man? You know, you shouldn't be CEOs of or high senior executives of oil companies rarely jump into the news feed with items to shape narratives. They have surrogates to do that. But anyway, it was happening. A senior guy from Exxon did the same thing. I don't mind that either. So anyway, I'll wind this up here right now. Oil's pretty balanced. I don't have a lot of concern about Iran doing something radical right now. They're just trying to get the best deal they can get. They're screwed. And I think Trump has been very sane about this. He didn't kill anybody. He tried on March 2nd to offer a ceasefire, but his partner in the war, Israel, accelerated, you know, hostilities, and so Iran shut the strait. But if Israel had been chill, we probably would have had a 3-day war. But you know, we all know that the confusion around Israel, what their goals are. And Trump said, you know, your goals are not my goals. And Netanyahu said, my goals are not your goals. So here we are. Mm-hmm. So there's plenty of oil around. Probably too much oil is coming out of the strait all at once. So the front spreads are very weak. Brent's in contango. If the front spread is weak, that means there's too much oil. If contango tilts us down, that means there's too much oil. And there's limitations as to how quickly, you know, you can bring in like 20 VLCCs into the loop or into Houston and unload them. I mean, you know, they're going to sit out there and there's going to, and then they're going to, I think we're going to see inventory circling up. So there never really was a trade. I think the remaining managed money length that's still there, it's still very big. It's like 300 million barrels at least, or 320,000 contracts of net length across the five major products and futures on ICE and NYMEX. And it's not going to make any money for those guys, whoever's holding those, you know, unless, you know, something catastrophic happens. And that's like, you know, the crazy outlier. So I don't see any trades. You know, if oil rallies, sell some spreads. I think that's what I would probably do. Maybe fiddle around with flat price a bit. I don't plan on, you know, hitting any home runs in oil. So there it is. At least what I think.
Obviously, that's being reflected in price. But JJ, when we think about the necessity of having an SPR to be able to blunt the draw on inventories that we did see, let's say, how does that play into your view here on oil? And is that just basically going to get refilled at a, let's say a reasonable rate in order to get back to an inventory level that is a little bit more comfortable than, you know, quote unquote tank bottom?
All right. First of all, if you take commercial inventories, which were 412 million last week, and you add the SBR onto it, 390-ish, or maybe it's a little lower now. I don't know. I haven't even bothered to look at it. It's in the mid 300s anyway. And then you take, you know, our distillate reserve storage and gasoline storage and everything. We've got about 1.1 billion barrels combined in the United States. Okay. Available. So, you know, by that, I mean, it's readily deployable at any time that either crude or petroleum products. Which is this huge, huge, huge amount, right? Mm-hmm. So we are the largest producer in the world. Russia's a big producer. They only have 14 million in SPR, right? Why would they want to have an SPR? Their SPR is in their proven reserves. It's in their industry. It's in their infrastructure. We have millions of miles of pipeline. We have wells. We have robust import relationships. We have more oil velocity going through the United States than any other country in the whole world. So having an SPR was only functional to us because no one else wanted to use theirs. Taking the 8 billion barrels of reserves that I mentioned to you before, right? Let's break it down. Okay. So of those 8 billion, about 5.5 billion are crude. Of the 5.5 billion, 3 billion are commercial. 2.5 billion are SPRs. The SPRs, 2.5 billion of which, you know, we have one of the largest holdings, but China has, they combine there. So they have like, I don't know, nobody knows what they had. Kibisi said they had 1.8 billion. Kepler said they had 1.2 billion. So that, you know, these are good names. We got a 600 million swing there. So nobody knows, right? We just know China has a ton of crude. Mm-hmm. And they're still importing it, even though they've reduced their imports radically. So, okay. in the United States, we were able to create a term credit system where we could lend barrels to anybody. So we didn't really sell anything like Biden did. And the people who took our oil from the SPR, they didn't pay us cash for it. They just took the oil and said, okay, we'll pay you back in barrels and give you 25% more. And according to the term sheet, from November 26th to November 28th, right? So $172 million went out.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there were no sales or anything like that. So really, right now, we have credit relationships with companies like ExxonMobil and so forth, who have a credit rating that's almost as high as the United States Treasury. So if they owe us oil, we kind of think we're going to get our oil back, right? But we're not only going to get like the 100 barrels that we lent them, we're going to get 125. So we have more oil in the SPR now than we did, because like any balance sheet with liabilities and assets and so forth, our assets have gone up by 25%. And most of those loans, when they're received, let's say I lend you oil, 100 barrels, right? Well, and you owe it to me, let's say by March of 2027. So what are you going to do? You're going to go right into the forward curve, which is trading 30 bucks cheaper or 20 bucks cheaper, and you're going to buy 100 barrels worth of oil stripped out, right, ratably, through the month of March, 27. So that buying demand is already in the market, although people say, oh, well, they got to buy it. Well, they already did buy it, right? So it's right here in the price right now. So all we have is a repo, a term repo. So there's the SPR for you. By the way, something we don't really need, but we had it. So we're going to make some money on it for the first time since we ever had it. In 1977, when the SPR was created, we had to have it. After all, you know, OPEC just jacked us up big time. But I guess when Bush raised the ceiling to 700, and I don't know, and change million barrels and said, we're going to fill it to there. I mean, that was just a nice thing to do for the oil producers, because it added ratable demand to the market every day. And somebody, you know, we were buying. The United States government was a buyer. So if you knew you had that bid every day, it added to it. So like I said, Canada, many countries who are part of the IEA community that were willing to contribute some, most people at Teaspoon, the United States contributed half of it, to the emergency releases. Many of them don't have any in-tank storage for SPR, although they're supposed to, and so there's a carve-out called in-ground storage. That's really funny. That means you have wells.
Yeah. Well, I find it really interesting to talk about and dissect really the changing nature of the need for the SPR, right? This is, I think, an underappreciated dynamic that the market has created through, you know, greater efficiencies, building of industry. Obviously, you know, it can't always respond at a moment's notice, but through, I guess, in aggregate, we have a lot more of availability of this product than we did when it was initially created, right?
Yeah, we have, you know, we're going to have 450 million barrels just, you know, when these term repos finally wind up, you know, being paid off. And I don't know, maybe politically we'll buy a few more barrels. We don't really need them. You know, it's just a massive, I think that the stress point for crude, because alternatives have matured to a point where we have a growing nuclear, just massive amounts of natural gas in the world, which are readily available. Even here in America, you know, nobody really knows quite how much. Some say it's like 200 years of supply at current rates of consumption. I don't know. Whenever I hear that kind of stuff, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, well, let's see what happens, you know, in 10 years or 5 years. Because I've seen natural gas go, right now it's trading, like I was a local in the Merck for many years, you know, trading the pits. And when they listed natural gas in the 90s, they told us, everybody, you know, we had to go into the natty pit and trade at least 10 lots a day in order to support the new contract. Did you know? This is blow your mind. Where's Natty now? I just got to look at this. Where the hell is it? So like Natty's trading 328. Okay, so it's trading around 250 when we first launched the contract. And for most of last year, you know, it was on two handles. So, you know, it looks terrible. It looks like it's going back. Like, where was it? Last November, it was trading to 26th, Natty was down to like $1.25. You know, just to give you an idea of just how vast, how galactic the supply of hydrocarbons are in the United States. So when you hear people say dumb stuff like tank bottom, which, you know, is just, it's not, it's abusive, particularly people who know better, who have spent their lives in research, you know, highly paid senior people who know the difference are running around saying, oh, we're going to run out of oil. Oh, just you wait by July. It's going to be really, shit's going to hit the fan. Oh, yeah. Anyway, I'll finish up this tank bottom thing and then we'll just quit, okay? We'll go to gold or something. There's no such thing as tank bottom. Like they say that about Cushing, and you know, I've written this on Substack and I published a couple of notes on X about it. There are somewhere, I don't know, between 300 and 400 tanks in Cushing, which is the smallest blending hub facility in the whole U.S. system. It has a max capacity of about 90 million barrels, but I've never seen it there. Highest I ever saw it was 76 million barrels. And when it was at 76 million barrels, the whole WTI crude curve collapsed as deep as, just for the front month roll, as cheap as $6 contango, because there was no place to put it. So you had to pay someone, sell your oil $6 cheaper. Where are we now? We're trading oil. So I would have to sell Augie $6 under SEP just to get it off, just to get off my run before expiration. So some of those wells, I mean, some of those tanks, you know, they're valuable. They take a lot, cost a lot of money to make them. It takes time to make them. Then there's a sludge line and then there's a tap, right? It sits above the sludge line. And over time, sludge is just filth and crap and sulfur over, you know, decades and stuff. It rises in the tank. So the taps go up like that, right? So it has to be a minimum amount on top of it. So that is what you'll call tank bottom, right? But just because, I don't know, some of the tanks are idle, you know, at 20 million, maybe 50 are idle and 300 are filled and operating normally, you know, because if they needed capacity, like we're bringing in, you know, all this oil out of the Middle East, all of a sudden comes at once, it's got to go somewhere. So we have, you know, we have 412, so we could probably put, you know, 20 VLCs in pad three, but then it's going to have to find someplace else to go. So it's probably going to go north to pad two. It's a long way to go to pad one. You can't get it into pad five. Pad four is up in the northwest and it's dinky. That's a pass through for you guys in Alberta, right? So yeah, then maybe they'd have a reason to ship some oil up, push some oil up to Cushing again. you know, and it's the benchmark hub for NYMEX. So if they put too much up there, spreads are going to crash. It's going to screw the index players. Any AUM that's in there, you know, like USO, they've been doing great because, you know, they've been capturing backwardation. USO, by the way, I get a lot of smart readers, so they always tell me stuff. One guy told me a couple weeks ago that USO had 165% of free float short. That's like GameStop. Right. It's bigger than GameStop. Mm-hmm. Why are they short? Because they're capturing the contango. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, the backwardation. USO stripped out after April 2020 when they went to negative, right? Everybody fled USO because it was just catastrophic. You know, the returns were just heinous. So they got some really smart guys. Actually, I knew a couple of them to get together, and they recreated the term structure of USO to go all the way out, I don't know, into the reds and blues, maybe, you know, that would be year and year after. So very low gamma out there, right, for the longer days, the curves like this. So anyway, USO is really big short because there's backwardation. So you collect money just being short USO. Anyway, and there's your tank bottom for you. It's a myth. No one's gonna, no, you know, if they had to put 5 million in Cushing just to put a little, you know, a little margin above the tap line and a few tanks, they do it. It's the NYMEX benchmark. No one's gonna let that fail, right? And it certainly isn't gonna happen with the velocity of throughput we have now in pad three, where they're running incredibly 96, 97, 98% capacity utilization every week and exporting millions and millions, millions and millions gasoline and distillates. Mm-hmm. So there.
Well, JJ, you know, this entire picture that you've painted seems to me to be, let's say, very, very misleading at best, right? Or a great misunderstanding of how this stuff works. And I think combining this with some of Trump's comments on, I believe it was when he was speaking at the G7, saying, you know, we would come out and say something and the market would go up, and then, you know, we'd get into more trouble and we'd come out and say something else and the market would go back up. You know, it just seems like this entire thing is just fabricated and completely manipulated, unless you really understand the workings behind it. So is that an accurate way of kind of portraying how you see the market right now?
Yeah. So I say it all the time in my writing on Market Vibes. If you have a narrative that is not validated by prices, ignore it.
That's a great way to put it.
Right? Something's not right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been doing this all my life. So a lot of this, I'm talking to you about stuff. It's just, it's in me, you know, it's like in my DNA. I don't know, maybe it's that, not there, but you know, it's a kind of certainty. When I hear, you know, or read stuff on X, some people, there's a guy in your neck of the woods. I'm not going to mention him by name, but he's a very hard worker, very respected, big proponent of Canadian energy stocks and so forth, who I think is genuinely ignorant of the real facts about what's happening in oil. And these guys like that, are learning what went wrong. You know, because there are reasons, you know, and, you know, corn farmers in Iowa are not going to tell you they have a big crop. It just ain't going to happen, right?
Right.
They don't want to say that. Oil producers, if you have ever been an oil producer who's going to tell you he has too much oil? Never. It's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's not in their interest, which is one reason why they don't say a lot. Although occasionally, like last May, when we just went down after in April, I think we traded as low as like 55. The head of Diamondback, I've traded, I've owned that stock many times, made money on it. I don't think I've ever lost money trading it. He said, look, you know, we're not gonna waste our money drilling down here at 60 or under 60 at 59. You know, we're gonna run our wells, we're paid to produce oil, so we're gonna do that, but we're gonna protect our capital. Mm-hmm. And we're gonna be in a position to deploy that capital if we get opportunities. So you don't see him out there right now saying, hey, we're pumping a lot of oil and we're taking advantage of this. They're just doing what they do, right?
Yeah.
They do that kind of thing. And the United States has more than 46 billion known barrels of reserves. It is, as I said, probably the most sophisticated and well-managed industry of any sector, you know, that I know of. I don't know a lot about AI and all these guys. They have to be pretty smart because they have trillions of dollars. But the oil industry is exquisitely managed because from wellhead to the pump where you actually get a product that has value, in order to get it out of the ground, to get it into a tank, to get it in a pipeline, get it on a ship, get it across the oceans, deliver it to another center, put it into a secondary storage where it's going to get processed, ready for refined, marketed, then sent all the way downstream to distribution all over the United States at more or less, say, homogeneous and uniform price before taxes. Who knows what they do after that? And then deliver it to you at a stable and predictable price. You've got to really know what the fuck you're doing. Mm-hmm. Every step along that chain it can be expensive if you don't manage it properly. So all of those guys, all of it. And you know what? You can't build new refineries, and every now and then, no matter how well you try to take care of them, they blow up. Mm-hmm. Just because of the physics of it, right? And then, so that's a problem. Go ahead.
I was going to say, on the other side of that, we see the dollar gaining strength. So can this mean that there is a shortage of dollars right now for the market?
Yeah. Well said. There's not enough dollars, you know, and dollars have a term structure. They have, you know, the dollar market is just amazing. You know, it's the deepest, most liquid market in the history of man. And then, you know, we have, but, you know, rising dollars, kind of like a headwind for oil. You know, and if you want to trade oil, I mean, I think for a very brief time, there was a question about petrodollars and with blah, blah, blah. So that wasn't renewed, but it didn't really need to be. There was never a treaty or a document that, you know, codified petrodollars. It was just an agreement. So you need dollars if you want to trade oil, period. And particularly if you want to buy oil from us. So there's a bit of a shortage of that. And on a macro sense, people have been dumping their dollars for, I don't know how long, more than 10 years, mm-hmm. right? The BRICS fizzled. India said, hey, well, we changed our mind. We don't want to be part of the BRICS, you know? And I think, although people may not like this, you don't have to be friends with people you do business with. And it's highly likely that Russia's position in oil and their association with India and China is unassailable. So, you know, we're going to be doing a lot of business with Russia. They've even said they want to dollarize again. So people are going to have to, you know, they think reserves went from 70% in the Y2 teens, you know, pre-Brexit. And now they're down to like 58%. That's a pretty big swing. And everybody's been dumping their treasuries, which is silly because if you're going to hold dollar balances, you need to treasuries, right? Mm-hmm. And foreign direct investment in the United States is like vertical. Mm-hmm. That happened in the 90s. FDI was, you know, a huge part of the economic boom we had in the 90s. We had the internet, and then we had all the formation of tech companies around it and foreign direct investment fueling it. So it's very much the same kind of thing we have going on here right now, which makes it kind of hard with all this FUD, you know, swirling around equities. It just, it's, this can't happen. It's too high. It's got to crash. We're going to crash. Don't buy it. It's going to crash, but it never crashes. Mm-hmm. Right? Stocks go up.
Back to your point about the narrative not being confirmed by price.
Exactly. Right. You know, we don't really know what's going to happen, you know, well, let me say this. So I said we had a really docile, it's been docile 5 months. We had a kind of melt up in January, which was pretty amazing, you know. I don't know if we'll ever see one of those in gold and silver again. I mean, it doesn't mean they can't, you know, trade back up into that zone again, but I don't think we're going to have the kind of, you know, forces back there again. You know, it's very hard. They have to be organically created. You can't manufacture them. So it's been quiet. And now we're, you know, I don't know, you know, how Trump's going to like wind this thing up. He's trying to just, you know, get out of the bathtub dry, if you ask me. You don't want to be. You never want to get in this war. But, you know, if you're elected president, you accept the responsibilities of the past presidents that they've committed you to. You may not like the treaties that you were signed into, but you still have to execute the responsibilities of the office, right? So everybody tends to conflate, you know, the IRGC with Iran. The IRGC is not Iran. They're Praetorian Guard. They're like the Schutzstaffel, I think, anyway, right? They've got their own. They got their own everything. They got their own Navy, their own army. Well, they don't have it anymore because Trump wiped it out. But, you know, they have their own banking system. They have everything is set aside. So Trump is not the the presidency and Trump are two different things. Mm-hmm. Just like, you know, Carney is not Canada. He's a guy, right? He got elected. You voted for him. That's it, right? A lot of people don't like that anymore. They change their minds. Well, you'll have your opportunity to vote for someone else. I've seen some pretty interesting candidates. I'm not Canadian, but I have a lot of Canadian family. So, you know, I know a little bit about it. I don't want to say I know a lot, but, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on up there. And this third quarter is really like, this is halftime, like in a very important, you know, it's like a Super Bowl game we have here right now. It's being played. It's the second 2 years of Trump's presidency. There's never been anybody quite like him ever. I think, at least in American history. And I have a feeling it's going to get really bumpy, particularly with Powell sitting on the FOMC and Warsh doing the things he wants to do. And Bessent seems to be highly competent at restructuring the way the United States manages its liquidity and funding. So all of these things are going to, you know, are all going to start to come together, you know, and quickly. Mm-hmm. In Q3.
Well, you know, continuing on this theme of price either confirming or not confirming, or the numbers confirming a narrative, you know, recently we had, I believe it was the May numbers of strength of the American consumer coming out and showing that spending and income were both up for May. So do you think that that's reflecting the accurate sentiment of the average American consumer? Or is that, you know, showing that prices are up, therefore spending has to go up because you still need the same basket of products?
So 60% of the increase in CPI in May came from oil. And I think more or less the same in April, but it wasn't as, there wasn't enough time because the way the BLS operates is, you know, it's a survey and a very poor responsive data comes in. So it's very stale. So there was that. So oil is back down. So whatever price implications there were from CPI on consumer spending should reverse. I don't know whether they will or they won't. I don't have a lot of confidence in the BLS because it's, you know, it's never been right. I mean, they're just a constant sequence of revisions after revisions after revisions. September of last year, they revised employment down by almost a million jobs for 2025 and 2024. The combined 2 years was almost 1.8 million overstatement of jobs. And then, you know, we have big surges and jolts. I think we have jolts tomorrow. Last month it was like 761, was 661 a job openings expected, right? It's just crazy, you know, it's all over the place. So when they shut the floors, I tried trading on screens and I lost like 300 grand right away. And my wife said, stop doing that. So I learned to write code. So I studied, you know, how to write in VBasic and I never became really a great, great at C# or the upper levels of it. But I was able to write in CQG, which is a form of C# where, you know, I was able to write systems. So what I learned, I was also a beta trader on CQG's auto trader because I decided I was just going to try to create a no-touch system, which I never could do, but I didn't lose a ton of money. What I learned is that the BLS is very much like systematic trading. It tells you what was. Mm-hmm. Right. And depending on how far back you go with what was in history, you may think that you're assuring your views of what will be, but you're really not. The most important things that I learned about analyzing data in any form is the fewer parameters you have, the less divergence you're going to have. Right. The more parametric variables you have, the greater potential for divergences, unintended consequences. So you're out there running along, oh boy, this is great. All of a sudden something happens. You go, wow, I just lost a lot of money. Why'd that happen? Well, same thing happens with the BLS. You know, they have, I don't know what you have. I think they have at least 400 PhD economists there cooking algorithms and seasonalities and birth death and all this other stuff about the things that they create, which sounds great. And it kind of works great when there's not a lot going on. You have a very narrow band of volatility and all of a sudden, whoosh, boom. And you look back on what the FOMC has done and it's terrible. You know, you would fire somebody who traded like that. Who in their right mind would decide, well, I don't want to even talk about COVID, but you know, they wind up acting smart about playing whack-a-mole all the time and losing tons of money. So said, hey, you know, we're not going to do that anymore, which means, what if I think he's right about that, we're going to start to use live data a lot more, which if you're trying to make money in the market, you do not make trades based on what you saw last May, right? You're trading the screen right now. You're managing your trade right now. And if anybody who does it, you know, other than that, is probably, you know, not going to, well, they're not going to be doing it for a long time. Unless, of course, you work for the BLS or the F1C.
Yeah.
Then you can do that.
So that kind of brings us, JJ, to the current market. You were saying before we started recording that you think this is a good time to be basically in cash and cash equivalents. And that kind of brings up this idea of, let's say, treasuries and bonds. How do you factor in the idea of real rates in this current environment as well?
You mean like the R star?
Well,
you know, the neutral rate?
How do you think about the idea of getting back your principal along with whatever the let's say the real rate of return on your yield minus inflation actually is?
I guess the short dated munis would be the best way to, you know, play that game, because you take the taxes out of it, right? So whatever you're getting, less inflation, is real. So that's one way to go. A lot of work, though, and a lot of risks. Municipalities aren't what they used to be. You can still make money on them. You know, I don't know what McDominay's going to do. He's going to have to pay through the nose if he keeps doing what he's doing now to fund his budgets. So, you know, people like, so what would I do? What I do is I like treasurydirect.com, which is, you know, it's just, you open an account with them. You can, anytime you have cash you want to put to work, you can just go into Treasury, click on the auctions that you want to participate in, click, 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 put in your dollar amounts. When the auction is done, the Treasury goes right into your checking account, takes the money, and now you hold it there. You're holding your money at the New York Fed. And, when the securities term out, they put them right back in your checking account, or you can put an auto roll on it, right? So that's a low stress way to ladder your own money. I like the long end a lot better than the short end right now, just because I think we're going to be in a period of disinflation. I think that long rates are probably going to go down maybe 100 basis points. And that would be 10s to 30s. So, you know, I kind of like the gyros there. If I'm wrong, so what? You know, I just wait it out and I'll take my money. You know, it's not like, but if I'm wrong in Meta, or I'm wrong in SpaceX, or something like that, you know, I have to make sure that my risks are balanced, not my assets are balanced, right?
Right.
But how much can I lose? You know, so I know what I'm going to make, lose, sort of thing. And outliers, the Treasury goes bankrupt. I doubt it. Or, you know, something bad happens to one of these big companies and it takes all of them down. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, we have April 2025 again. And I don't really want that. Right. So I like miners, gold miners, because they make so much money, right? Yeah, I can take P&L swings as long as I know the companies I'm making are making insane, stupid amount of money. Mm-hmm. That is a kind of like a comfort thing. I don't have to even watch them. As a matter of fact, a lot of times I don't even look at them. I know what they're doing, right? It's like, where are your kids? 7 o'clock. I know where my miners are.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. The oil companies, I don't know. They may have a downswing here, but as I said, they are supremely well managed. They're poised to capitalize on what's happening in Trump world for the next couple of years for sure. So if oil companies go down, I like I like the pipeline companies. Like, you know, all of them pay just a really great dividend. Energy Transfer's like 7.5%. KMI, which is really a stock that never really moves around much, but it's still, it pays like in the fives. Other, you know, moving, transporting oil, things like that. It's just going to be a lot of oil moving around. And, you know, if it goes down, I haven't been bullish on oil, but if it goes down, I will be.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, JJ, I really appreciate you showing us the your understanding of the oil market that is, you know, garnered by many years of being in these trenches, looking at different aspects of it. You know, I used to build some of the tanks and some of the infrastructure being a welder here in Alberta. So I've seen that side of it too. I've seen how long some of these projects take. And it's always really interesting to, you know, let's say put the idea behind how long and how much of an investment some of these projects take to, you know, exactly what you just said. These companies are supremely well managed, and that doesn't mean that the headlines match the actual boots on the ground reality of what is happening, right? And yeah, I think that's really important to keep in mind.
So you know how specious that tank bottom narrative is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds smart, but it's absolutely wrong, right? It's just goofy. Yeah. And plus, since you built them, you know that they're not cheap. So no one's going to let them, I don't know. So anyway, listen, my pleasure. Last thing I would say is the thing about these markets is if you can laugh at them, you understand them.
Yeah.
If you're worried about them, you don't understand.
That's a really important thing to keep in mind. Of course, for listeners that want to read any more of your work, you put out, you know, sometimes 2 to 3 pieces a day. That's all available at jj745.substack.com. And of course on X as well at Alyosha, Alyosha 745. JJ, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, sir. My pleasure.